now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Pierre Sabbach. Pierre Sabbach is the author of The Murder of Reality and Holographic Culture. He is an expert in the hidden symbolism of the dragon. He has made an in-depth study about etymology, the roots of words, and he has uncovered the fact that this reptilian serpent force has been behind the scenes all along, manipulating human society, human civilization, human culture. So without any further ado, Pierre Sabbach, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Great. Thank you for inviting me on, James. I'm actually very excited to speak to you because I'm aware of your work in the UK through Chris Turner's work. He's a filmmaker, and I know you've done several interviews with him. So it's fantastic to be able to speak to you at long last. So thank you for inviting me on your show.
That's quite all right, Pierre. We've got so much ground to cover, and I would like to make this like a regular or semi-regular gig between us because you've got so much information to share. Tell us about your coming into this work and what drew you into it, and a bit about your background and how that all came into play.
I studied fine art, and as a young man, I really wanted to be an artist, but I was very interested in semiotics, and semiotics studies the sign, and it's very complementary towards symbolism. And so I became interested in this. I think, though, the interest really stemmed much earlier, because when I was a child, I saw what looked like a rocket in a field. Now, it was quite some distance away. It was sort of approximately about a field away. And it seemed to be about the size of a silo, and it actually looked like a silo. And it kind of took off, and it flew on a right angle. It flew quite high, and it flew above my head. And I went indoors to my grandma, and I said, "I've just seen a rocket, Grandma." And she said, "Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, whatever." I don't think she knew what to make of it. Perhaps she just thought I'd been playing. And from then onwards, I had a really profound interest in flying saucers and the occult and the paranormal. And so then basically I went to university and I studied fine art. I studied the sign or semiotics. And then I started to read authors such as David Icke and Robert Temple. Now, Robert Temple, he wrote a book called The Sirius Mystery, and he argued that the Dogon people, that they had contact with this reptilian race of beings, which were referred to as the Nomo. And what was fascinating about this book was that he put forward a very strong thesis, but it was from an academic perspective. And I don't think it really hadn't been done before. I know we had authors like, I'm trying to think, the German author who wrote The Chariots of the Gods.
Von Daniken.
Van Dyneken, that's right. But again, his work wasn't really academic. His work was more philosophical. So I think that his work, it really excited the public's imagination because of the philosophical ramifications of ancient aliens. But it didn't really excite, shall we say, the imaginations of the academics, because the academics just basically pulled the work to pieces. So I think Professor Temple's work, The Sirius the book on Sirius, really helped to put this subject seriously within academia. Now, unfortunately, there hadn't really been any serious books on ancient aliens for probably 20 years. Then at the same time as reading Professor Temple's book on the Sirius mystery, I then came across David Icke's work. And I think that was very interesting, because David Icke's work is really a unified theory on the serpent, and his book branches into politics, into symbolism. And I really, again, David Icke's work was very influential. And his work excited my curiosity. But there was a part of his work which I kind of felt limited in that there was a lot of anecdotal information. And that doesn't mean that the information is true or it's false. It's just information which is interesting, but it's very difficult to quantify. And so there was a part of me which was thinking, I really want to study this and I want to understand this better. And is there further evidence or proof that there has been alien intervention? And so this is when I really began to study the serpent. And as I began to study the serpent, I realized that through the study of etymology, that there were these patterns and word plays and word associations, which was a unified code, which is found within human language. Now, in my book, Holographic Culture, I refer to this as the artifact. And the artifact is the alien code, which is encrypted within human language. And this code is universal. And by this, I mean it's found within every single culture. And it's almost like the DNA. It's the signature of the aliens. It's how they have encoded themselves, almost imprinted themselves indelibly upon our culture, upon our language, upon our sociology, upon our psychology. And I think that this is important to understand because language controls behavior. So therefore, if you control language, then you control behavior. And this is really what the artifact is. It is this code which encrypts the others or the aliens. They were known in the ancient Semitic as visitors, strangers, angels, aliens. These are all terms which are used to describe them. And so that was basically my starting point, was the symbolism. And it was through the study of etymology. So yeah.
David Icke's book had a formative influence on many people. And then those of us in my field at the time, we were quite gratified that somebody would actually put together a book, because I'd read his previous book, And the Truth Shall Set You Free. And then he segues into the reptilian aspect. And I can say that was quite a cause for celebration for many of us, because finally it seemed that this subject was getting into the mainstream. Titled your book, The Murder of Reality, can you explain to our listeners and viewers what you meant by that, and also how it speaks to the pervasive nature of this reptilian serpentine influence?
Okay. I got the title of the book came from the English translation of the French French philosopher Baudrillard. Now, he was very influential within semiotics because he really deconstructed the sign. Now, he wrote a book called The Ultimate Crime. And in the book, The Ultimate Crime was the murder of reality. And essentially, he was talking about the replacement with the simulacrum, which is the replacement with the false, and therefore the destruction of reality. And in some respects, it has very strong connotations of the Gnostic tradition, in terms of that reality is somehow is false, or it's being falsified, and that the real is the spiritual, which lays behind the reality. It's the ulterior reality, which is more real and which imprints itself upon this physical reality, but this physical reality has somehow been distorted. And so the murder of reality seemed very appropriate to talk about this hidden tradition, which has been disguised through this private discourse, which in the Greek is known as ideoglossolalia, literally a private discourse. And so you're seeing that these symbols reoccur through the artifact, which is this code within language, which appertains to these aliens, which were known as angels. Now, in my book, Holographic Culture, I describe them as angelic sailors. And this is a key subject which we really need to go into in order to understand this. But essentially, it's going back to what I refer to as the scaphological tradition, which is the study of ships within, angelic ships within the religious and the mythological tradition. Now, in order for us to understand mythology, religion, allegory, fables, we need to be conversant with the idea of an angel, which is essentially angelos, a messenger. But the messenger is typically represented in combination with a boat or a vessel. And the thing is that this relates to the classical tradition, and this has been classified. And just to give you an example of what I mean by the classical tradition, essentially the classical tradition is the naval tradition, which relates to the angels. So anything within symbolism relating to the navy relates to angels, but this is classified. And to give you an example within the etymology, we see that in the Greek and in the Latin, classis denotes a naval fleet. Now, classis also appertains to class. So one who is born from a naval fleet is a lordship. It's one who is born of a boat. In the Hebrew, this would be the Ben Sira. And therefore, the classical tradition, which relates to the angels, classis, a naval fleet, is classified. It's hidden. It's been redacted. And this is the classical tradition, which is essentially the scaphological tradition, which is the study of boats within religion and mythology. It interconnects with the angel, and in the Aramaic, Zah is an angel, but it's a polymorphic word because in the Aramaic, Zah also means an angel, a stranger, a visitor, or an alien. So an angel is synonymous with an alien. And Zah also relates to Sira, which is a boat. So there's this correspondence between Zara, an angel or an alien, Sira, a boat. And again, Sa, which is a prince. We would say in English, lordship. Now, the reason why we refer to the noble lineage as lordship is because he is one who is born of a boat. One who is born of a boat is descended from the angels. So we see that there's a relationship between Malak and angel, which is a polymorphic symbol. In other words, it has a multiple meaning. The other meaning of the word Malak, an angel, is Malak, which is a sailor. So the angel is an angelic sailor and is equated with the bloodline of the king, Melech a king. In English, we would say kingship. Therefore, in English, we would describe kingship in another way as highness. Highness because he is descended from heaven. When we render this into the Aramaic, the high ones are the Elohim, the generic term for the gods, but literally it's coming from Elah, meaning high. And so they are the high ones or the lofty ones. And so we refer to, again, also within the Greeks, Sebastos, an emperor, is related to Thaboeth, which is the angelic host. And so again, within the lineage, the emperor is originated from this angelic lineage. And again, what's very interesting about the Greek word for Caesar as well, in Greek, the word for Caesar, the king Caesar, is Caesar. But this is a diptych paronomasia. It's a special symbol because in Hebrew, Caesar means a spaceman or an alien, which again has this multiple meaning of an angel, alien or visitor. So, for example, in the modern Hebrew, Caesar, which is a spaceman, literally K is living and Zar is an alien, also used in Aramaic to denote an angel. So a spaceman is an angel or is a living deity, as in an Elak, a high god. Elake is a high god. Caesar is a space alien, but they are one and the same, and they appertain to the Elohim. And this is the scaphological tradition, which is this classical tradition, which is classified and relates to the naval tradition, which is a morphological adaptation on the word. Naval is a morphological adaptation on noble, as in noble bloodline, but again coming from noblest to know, as in gnosis, and the noble ones, as in noblest to know, are related to the high ones. And so, if you like, it completes the full circle. Kingship, lordship, these all relate to angels, and we'll get into what I mean by an angel in a moment, but I'll pause there and I'll see if you have any questions. And
no, please continue.
Yeah, okay, so when we're dealing with angels, and I think that this is another important thing, and in some respects it relates to the modern tradition of Milab, which again is just an occult signifier of something which is much, much more ancient. So Milab is referring to this idea that you have aliens which work with the military, which there's a human component, but this is also found within the ancient traditions. So I really want to try and impress upon your audience this idea that there are essentially two sets of angels, and these two sets of angels are represented within the occult tradition. And so within the occult tradition, you have secret knowledge relating to human angels, and you have secret knowledge relating to non-human angels. Within Freemasonry, this is represented as the three pillars of Freemasonry. And this is very, very important. So, for example, if I was to give you some etymologies, we could say that the word Sofef, which is a watcher, is related to Sefef, which is a serpent, a seraph, and is related to Saba, which is an army. Now, so therefore, Sabaoth, which is the angelic host, when we break down the etymologies, is closely concordant with Sefef, a seraph. And so we're dealing here with the seraphic host. And therefore, they made, if you like, a demarcation between the seraphic host, which was the non-human host, and their combination with the human host. And so when you look at, for example, the seraphim, you see that there's a connection with the seraphim and the host. But they're equated with boats and vessels. So, for example, seraph, a serpent, is morphologically related with Sapan, a seaman or a sailor, and Safina, which is a boat or a ship. The same word plays are also found with the human host as well, with the cherubim. So, for example, cherub is related to carib, which is a small boat or a vessel. It's a carrier boat or a vessel. Now, the cherubim, typically within symbolism, are represented as armed angels. We would describe them as a marine. That would be the best translation, because they are armed, and they're a type of sailor, because they're equated with boats. Now, within the symbolism, what you often typically see is you'll see that the flying saucer, which is depicted as a wheel in the ancient Aramaic ophanim, meaning the wheels. Now, again, it's plural because these vessels are constructed as a series of wheels. But the ophanim typically are depicted with the symbol of the serpent, which is combined around a wheel. And sometimes this wheel will be combined with a throne, as in a throne chariot. Within angelology, the throne is a type of angel, but the throne is used to denote the ophanim wheels, which are these chariots. So a chariot or a wheel, a spinning wheel is a flying wheel. And you'll see, combined with the wheel, a serpent, so Sephira, which is a wheel, or a representation of the wheel, combined with the seraph. And on the throne, you'll see a human holding a sword. Cherub is the cherubim, cherub, which is a sword. Combined together, this represents the human and the seraphic host. And the seraphic host are these entities which are considered as alien. Zar, an angel, alien, stranger, or visitor. And so the combination of the two is denoting this alliance between human and non-human angels. And as we said, they're identified with sailors. And just to reiterate the point, Malak, an angel, is polymorphic of Malak, a sailor. But we see also with the non-human host, the seraph is identified with Sapan, a sailor, Safina, which is a ship. Again, with the cherub, the cherubim in the plural, or the cherub, the singular, is equated with carib, which is a boat or a vessel. And so they're all identified with boats, ships, and vessels. And again, they're often symbolized with boats, ships, and vessels. And so, for example, within Catholicism, you might see in some of the more esoteric images, the Virgin Mary, for example, holding up a boat. The boat is used to denote the son of a boat, as we said, Malak, an angel, Melek, a king, this royal lineage, which is identified with the angels. And so this is an important thing. And I think that when we look at the seraphim and where they originate, we actually can get concrete. We know exactly where they come from, and that's through the breakdown of the etymologies. And I can actually go into that and give you a deconstruction of where the seraphim originates from. Now, obviously, as we all know, what we're dealing here is that there are multiple beings and multiple entities. But within symbolism, at least, you're seeing time and time again the representation of the seraphim and the cherubim, which is this dialectic between two principal players. And the reason for this is that although there are multiple entities visiting this planet, the entities that control this planet come from Sirius. And we know this for a fact because we can break down the etymologies, and I can go in into that with the viewers if you want me to go into
that. Yes, please continue.
Okay, so for example, we said that Zar is an angel, alien, stranger, or visitor, which is equated with Sira, a boat. Now, Sira, a boat, is a Hebrew word, Sira, a boat, but it works on a special type of wordplay, which is known as diptych paronomasia. So this is a wordplay which switches from one language into another. So Sira, which is a boat, in Hebrew, in Arabic, Sira means Sirius. So the Ben Sira in the Hebrew, the son of a boat, which is an angel, Malak an angel, Malak a sailor, is concordant with the Ben Sira, which is a son of Sirius. So the sons of Sirius are typically represented with the halo. Again, halos a halo in the Greek is a wordplay on alos, meaning the others or another. This is the others as in the alos genes, which is an alien. Again, the alien is typically used to denote an angel or a messenger, and their flaming wheels, which are identified with ships, boats, vessels, spinning wheels, and also spinning shields. And we can talk about the symbolism of the shield and how that relates to the boat. But essentially, within the scaphological tradition, there are two ways of representing an angelic boat. Number one, you have a wheel, a spinning wheel, and that is often combined with a throne, and therefore the symbol of the chariot. So a throne or a throne chariot, or the throne can be on a raised platform, which is circular. Again, that is denoting the wheel. And then you have the shield, and the shield is typically adorned on the boat, and therefore the shield is used to denote an angelic boat or a vessel. Hence in Greek, the correspondence between pleon, a boat, opalon, a shield. Now, opalon, a shield, relates to opalite, a soldier, in this respect, in the symbolism, the angelic host, which again is equated with arpui, which is an abductor. We would say a harpy. Now, the harpies were represented with talons because they would steal people. And so the tradition of abduction is extremely ancient. It's not going back to Whitley Strieber into the 1980s. Despite what all the cynics and all the debunkers would have you know, this is ancient. In the Latin and the Roman mysteries, this was known as nymphaleptos, to be stolen by the nymphs. But again, we're seeing that there's an etymology in English between dragon and to drag, as in to drag off. Again, in the Greek, thoros, a lizard, thurois, to steal away, drasomi, dragon, drakon, lambano is to steal or to take away, the lamia. The word plays are found within multiple languages, and this shows that the deities are equated with abduction, and they're equated with these ships and these vessels, and it goes back into the mythological tradition, the scaphological tradition, the study of boats within the angelic tradition, which is this classical tradition, which is classified. And this is why I think within modern ufology, the Navy keeps on coming up time and time again, because the Navy is equated to lordship and this angelic or noble lineage. And so this is why the Navy is always classified, because it's going back into this angelic tradition. So the symbols are there, but they have to be deconstructed through etymology. And this, if you like, this code found within language, I refer to this as the artifact, and the artifact is this universal code, and it works on polyglottal symbolism. So these are word plays which are repeated within multiple languages, and I think that this is really important, because we know that the deities are equated with flying shields, for example. As I said before, there was a correspondence between the Apui and Oplon, a shield, related to a Pleon, which is a boat. Now, lordship is often denoted, they represent themselves with a shield. They would represent themselves with an elevated shield. So the shield is placed on the wall, which is the family crest, denoting one who is born of a boat. But again, also within the Greek, there is this identification with Theos, which is a god, and Thurios, which is a shield. The shield of a deity is the Aegis. The Aegis is this flying shield. And again, even when you're looking at deities, the goddess, for example, within Greek statues, you'll see that there's a correspondence with Athena. Athena is sometimes shown with a shield, and inside of the shield, there is this serpent. Now, this is representing the seraphic host. The seraphic host is identified with a flying shield. And the dragon, or the seraphim, which are these non-human angels, is another word for the jinn. And therefore, we're seeing, and again, within the symbolism, it's going back into the Semitic. So a lot of the Greek symbolism was one step removed. It was going back into the Aramaic and into the Arabic, into the Semitic languages. So, for example, with the shield of Athena, in the Aramaic, you have Juna, a shield, coming from the etymology of Jana, which is to hide or to conceal, which relates to Jinn, which is again related to Jen, which is a serpent or a worm. So they're hidden, and they're hidden or protected behind this shield, which is a flying shield. And the Jinn is another word for the daemon. So in the Greek, daemon, daemon, amon is to hide or to conceal. So in the Arabic, Jinn is coming from the root Jana, to hide or to conceal. Within the Greek, daemon is a translation of the Arabic word amon, which is to hide or to conceal, through that which is hidden or concealed. So we know that the jinn are the same as the seraphim, because they are represented as the same. And this would then denote that the seraphim are one and the same with the Elohim. And the etymologies for that is complex, but I can explain that. And I think that this is really important to understand, that the gods are reptilian. So, for example, in the Greek, you see that there is this identification with theos, a god, and therion, which is a beast, which was used in the symbolism to denote a drakon. A drakon, again, is equated with archon, drakon and archon. But remember, archon, which is an angel or a ruler, is related both to the old Babylonian root akan, a seraph, but also olkas, which is a carrier vessel. So the archons, again, originates from a boat or a vessel, which is an ark. In the Greek, olkas, a large carrier vessel. And the archons are one and the same with the seraphim, hence akan, which is a seraph, ak, which is to shine, from the root to shine. So the seraphim, seraph, and seraph are fire. Now, fire is a very important signifier when we're dealing with the jinn, because the jinn are said to be born of fire. And what does fire signify? Well, fire signifies Sirius, because in the Arabic, Sira, which is Sirius, is coming from the root word Sara, which is a spark. And therefore, the seraphim are denoted with fire. Seraph, which is fire, seraph, which is a serpent. In the Greek, drakon, which is from the root drakein, which is to watch or to look, but is also can mean to flash. And therefore, the drakon, again, is equated with fire. Again, akan is coming from the root word ak, which is light. Akan is a seraph in the old Babylonian. So the seraph is identified with Sirius. Sira, which is Sirius, is the Hebrew word for Sira, which is a boat. In the Semitic mysteries, Sira denotes Sir, which is a mystery. It can also mean a sacrament as well. And this goes into sacrifice. And this is another important area, because when you look at the traditions of the votive dish is shown as a circle. And inside, there is a bobble almost inside, which looks like a watching eye. And at one level, it is representational of the watching eye. But also, it's denoting an axle or a wheel, because it's denoting the opening wheel. So the votive plate is denoting a flying saucer, which is essentially a vessel or a ship. So they're offering blood sacrifice to these flying vessels or wheels. Within the traditions. Now, what's very interesting is that hieroglyphically, Sirius is denoted as an axle and wheel. And so Sirius can be represented as a watching eye, because it looks like an eye and a pupil, which is an axle and wheel. And when you combine the symbolism together, you get the opening wheels. Now, within Judaic symbolism, the opening wheel is typically Ophan, pana, to turn or to spin, where you get the etymology of wheel from in the Hebrew. Same in English, wheel and whirl. It's polyglottal, so the word plays repeat in multiple languages. But the opening wheels are typically in Judaic symbolism represented with the eye, which denotes the watcher. Sofer for watcher, seraph, which is a serpent. Ophan, which is a wheel. Afar, which is a viper. So the opening wheels are denoting the watchers or the shining ones, which are identified with Sirius. And so when we go back into the traditions of the deities, for example, we see that with the Elohim, there's a correspondence between the Elohim and Erin, which is a watcher or a shining one. And this is important because the watchers or the shining ones are basically, it's another word for a dragon, because drakon is drakein, which is to watch or to shine. Sofer for watcher, seraph, which is a serpent. Polyglottal, you know, it's also found within the Greek. Theos, a god. Theos, a watcher. Phos, which is light, which is essentially the seraphim, the shining ones, the watchers or the shining ones. And so the Elohim, the high ones, the gods, are equated with Erin, which are the watchers or the shining ones, which again, in the old ancient etymologies, are identified with the Awim, which are the destroyers, the devastators, or is another word for a serpent. So the serpent is a personification of a god or a deity. And this is why the serpents were venerated within the traditions. I mean, this is the genus of the serpent, the Anguagina. The Anguagina is an offspring of a serpent. And so within the, let's say in the Greek and the Latin and Roman mysteries, Angelus and angel is equated with Angui, which is a snake. In the Hebrew, this would be the seraphim, which is a non-human angel, which is personified as the serpent. In the Hellene mysteries, this would be the dragon, and again, would be closely concordant with the archons, Achan, which is a seraph, equated with Olcas, which is a boat. In the Latin mysteries, Arc, which is a large vessel, ship, or a boat. So again, I think when we look at Yahweh Sabaoth as well, this is very interesting, because Yahweh Sabaoth, Sabaoth is equated with Saba, which is an army. Sabaoth is the angelic host. But again, Saba has this connotation of Sephath, which is a seraph. And so therefore, we're dealing here with the seraphic host. So Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of the host. And we get confirmation of this, or this is reaffirmed with the name Yahweh coming from the root Eya. Eya is the old Semitic transliteration of the name Yahweh. Eya is coming from the root Eya, which is the verb to be. Now, this is because Yahweh was represented as an entity. Entitas is to be. So Eya is to be, but is a wordplay on Aya, which is a serpent. And therefore, Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of the seraphic host. His other name is El Shaddai, Almighty God. But Shaddai is coming from the root word shed, plural shedim, which are a goblin, ghost, ghoul, or jinn. And so whether it's Yahweh Sabaoth coming from the root Eya, or Ayar, a serpent, Ayal, a goblin in the Arabic, or El Shaddai, Shedim, a goblin, ghost, ghoul, or jinn. So he is the Lord of the seraphic host, which again, circumstantially, would give strong circumstantial evidence that the Lord of the seraphic host is a seraphim. Hence, the watchers are represented with the eye. The eye is denotation of Sirius and the Ophanim wheels. And so understanding this gives you it gives you a new vocabulary. It gives you a new language in order to describe with a great deal of accuracy the landscape and the mythological landscape in which they were describing these entities. And I think what is very fascinating is that these entities are equated with different star systems within the mythological and the religious tradition. And it's very interesting because, again, when you're looking at the ufological tradition, the ufological tradition is not new. It's based on occult symbolism, and it's speaking through this allegory, this other speaking. So even when you're looking at people like Adamski, Adam, sky, okay? Adamski is an esoteric signifier of essentially in the Hebrew, the Bena Adam, the son of Adam. The son of Adam was a planted offspring which was placed upon the earth. The son of Adam goes back to Adam, meaning red. Mahadim is Mars. Adama is the earth. The red earth was Mars. That's a long story. The symbolism behind that is very complicated because the Adamic races were created in Orion. And again, the Nephilim again are equated with Orion. So Nephil, a giant, is equated with Nephilia, which is Orion, the old word for Orion. The other word for the Nephilim are the Gibberim. Again, Gibbor, which is Orion. And so what's interesting about the star constellation Orion is that the Adamic races were created in Orion. You've got Rigel, Rigo, which is where the Adamic races were created, but Yadal Jaza is where the Nephilim races were created and combined with the Seraphim. And so Yadal Jaza is the hand of the giant, which is essentially the hidden hand. So when Freemasons talk about the hidden hand, they're making an astro-theological reference to Orion, which again is going back into the esoteric traditions of the Nephilim. And therefore, the esoteric traditions of the Nephilim goes back to Eton, you know, the College of Eton, because the word Eton is the Anglo-Saxon word for a giant. So again, when you're dealing with the symbolism, the symbolism is going back to this occult traditions relating to the giants. And again, even when you're looking at the scientists as well, Sir Isaac Newton said that he stood on the shoulders of giants. Now, again, what's interesting about that is that he's referring to the Nephilim and he's making reference to his college, Eton, meaning the Anglo-Saxon word for a giant. But Yadal Jaza, the hand of the giant, the word was also known in the Arabic as the shoulder of the giant. It had two different words for the star system. So standing on the shoulder, he stood on the shoulder of giants, again, is another reference to the hand of the giant or the shoulder of the giants, depending on... depending on how it's represented in Arabic, because there are two different ways of representing this. So again, the depiction of the flying saucer, and again, Kenneth Arnold talked about the flying saucer, but the flying saucer, if you look at the date, 24th of June, this was when the Lodge of Freemasonry was instituted. And so it's an occult signifier. They were releasing information about the flying saucer, because the flying saucer, remember that the flying saucer, Kenneth Arnold, what he described wasn't a flying saucer. He described it. What's very interesting, it looked like a bat wing from Batman. Actually, when you look at it, it actually represents it represents symbolically 33, because the symbol at the back actually encodes 33, which is two triangles or the Jewish star, which is this combination of different bloodlines, which is a very complex symbol. But essentially, the occult and traditions and the flying saucer traditions and sci-fi, this is all going back to flying saucers. And the idea that these were flying saucers, they were described in the ancient languages as flying saucers. They were described as votive dishes, and they were equated with blood sacrifice as well, and the stealing of livestock and the stealing of human beings. And so it's a fascinating subject, but it's a subject which unfortunately is not really taken very seriously within academia. And this is because I think that there's been a psychological operation to undermine this within academia, a serious psychological operation. So for example, when you see Ancient Aliens, everything is always trivialized and everything is often wrong or incorrect or very problematic or very dubious. And so when academics look at this, they just think, well, this is ridiculous. So so there's a distortion within the facts. And if you look, for example, within the traditions of Ancient Aliens, for example, you'll see that the flying shields were, and this is very interesting because, as I said before, when you want to represent the boat and the symbol of the boat and the shield, they are complementary. They go together. A son of a boat is a son of a shield, and the boat and the shield are shown together within Hellene mythology, hence the correspondence between Pleon, a boat, Oplon, which is a shield. So you know, they go together. Theos, a god. Thurios, which is a shield. Jinn are a shield. These are flying shields, but the flying shield is interesting because originally it was not only was it closely concordant with the boat, the ship, or the vessel, but typically it was also closely equated with a flying missile. And this is because in ancient warfare, what they would do is they would take these large giant shields and they would fill them with excrement and burning sand, and sometimes they'd fill them with oil. Really hot oil, tie the shields together, and then they would fling them in these catapults and they would fly like giant frisbees, and they would sink ships, take out fortifications. And so the flying shields as this connotation not only of a boat but of a weapon or a missile. And this is why in the Latin word, when we see the word missile, missilis, it doesn't mean elongated missile as how we would view it, it has this strong connotation of a flying shield. Now, a flying shield is equated with a flying saucer, which is equated with a weapon. This is why within the Roman mysteries with Newman, the deity, there was a shield which fell to the earth. And when the shield fell to the earth, the goddess Elagaria, she said, whoever has the shield, they will be the most dominant race on the planet, because this is such a dangerous weapon. In other words, this was viewed almost like a missile. And so they made replicas of the shield and they hid the shield. And I think that this is actually very useful when we look at our military, because I think what the military are doing is they're often making copies of what these vessels are in order to study them. And so this is another important part. And again, the shields, when they get taken apart, they're constructed as a series of cogs or wheels. And so therefore, the cog, Shen, a cog in the ancient Aramaic, is equated with San, which is the saucer. And again, when you look at Frank Scully's book, he talked about how these flying saucers were constructed from a series of cogs. So for example, if we looked at Shen, which is a cog, San, which is a saucer, we see that there's a relationship with Zin, which is a boss of a shield. A boss of a shield is a spike. Now, the spike is important because when you have you basically have a shield with a spike, but which is a circle and a triangle, which is a Pythagorean symbol used to denote the descendants of a boat. But again, the circle and the triangle also represents a cog and a tooth because it's polymorphic. Shen, a cog, also means a tooth. And a tooth is used to refer to the planting of teeth, which is the dragon's offspring. But the tooth is relating to a cog. So the tooth is used not only to denote a descendant of a cog, it can also have connotations of the dog star, because obviously the canine tooth. The canine is a signifier of the dog. The dog star, Al-Kab, the dog, is related to Kabar, a messenger. And therefore, we're seeing that the ancient messengers are equated with Sirius. As we said before, Sarah, Sirius, Sarah, spark, Seraph, fire, Seraph, non-human angel, equated with Sofa for watcher, which is another word for Erin, a watcher, or a shining one, which are one and the same with the Elohim, the high ones. In the Greek, Theos, a god, Theros, a watcher, Phos, which is light. These are polyglottal symbols. And therefore, when we look at the deities, for example, the deities are represented with the dog star. So, for example, we would say in Arabic that in Arabic, Allah is a pun or a wordplay on awa, which is to bark. It's polyglottal, though. In English, God is a reversal of dog. Same in the Japanese. Kami is a god. Oo Kami is a wolf. We see also within the Roman mysteries, Lato is a polo. Latro is to bark or to snarl. Now, Lato Apollo is equated to Latin, the Latin language, Latens, which is to hide or to conceal. The hidden tradition is the occult tradition. Occult, oculus, which is an eye, which is used to know Drakos, which is an eye in the old classical Greek. Drakein, to watch or to flash, which is equated with Drakon or a dragon, which is the seraphic tradition. Now, interestingly, as I said before, that there are two occult traditions in classical philosophy. This is the Pythagorean Euclidean dialectic. Essentially, the priesthood is split, and the priesthood, at some respects, is antagonistic and at war with itself. But you're seeing that the priesthood is protecting knowledge. So you have non-human angels, which is the seraphic tradition, and then you have human knowledge, which is relating to the cherubim. Again, these are really proto-human angels, and these proto-human angels, essentially, from my understanding of the mythology, and the mythology is complex, and I can only give you a very simple breakdown of what occurred, because I'm still researching this. It's extremely complicated. We only have fragments of what really occurred, because we are suffering from amnesia. The human race is suffering from amnesia, and this is a real problem when trying to reconstruct the past. And not only this, just one moment. Sorry about that. So yes, we are suffering from amnesia. But essentially, there was a war in heaven, a Titanomachy, between what you could describe as the human element and the non-human element. Now, within the ancient symbolism, this relates to the Anthropos. The Anthropos are the proto-races, but the Anthropos became corrupted. This in symbolism is the fall of man, which is really the planting of the Adamic man on the earth, which is panspermia. The Greeks referred to this as panspermia. The Arabs in the Quran referred to this as the second creation, which is distinct from the first creation. First creation is the aeon and the expression of the universal forms into particularized forms, into the physical reality, which was the creation of the Anthropos. The creation of the Anthropos was the creation of the Elohim, of the humans, of the non-humans. But the but there was a war which was known as the Titanomachy, the War of the Titans, and then there was a covenant. The covenant is represented by Orion. And essentially, then there was the seraphim made this contract with humans. Now, my understanding of this is that the proto-humans and the seraphim are genetically non-compatible. So they created a race, which was the Adamic race, which is compatible both with the cherubim, which are these human angels, proto-human angels, and the seraphim, which are these non-human angels, which is the Adamic man. So that's what separates us from the cherubim, which are these proto-human angels. But also within the Judaic traditions, you have the Ishim. Ish is a man. The Ishim are the human angels. The human angels are essentially the Ben Adam, the sons of Adam, which are those who are born of a boat, but they are human. They're identical to ourselves, basically, but they are distinct from the cherubim. So that's my understanding. Again, when we're dealing with the war in the heaven and we're dealing with the Titanomachy, it may happen in the future. It could have been in the past. I'm not entirely sure about that because we're dealing with a holographic species. A holographic species, they've deconstructed the mechanics of waveform reality. They are outside of time. So time is not such a big thing for them. So when we look at ancient mythology, we tend to look at it as, oh yeah, they were referring to their past. That's a possibility, but we must keep an open mind that they could have also been referring also to the future. But either way, the outcome was the same, that human beings were planted on planet Earth and they were segregated through a caste system. And the caste or the class system was based upon whether one was born of a boat, whether one was derived from this angelic lineage. And so this is why we're seeing all this class warfare and this inequality because of this private tradition which is classified and which has been encoded through ideoglossolalia, which is this private discourse. And so that's, if you like, a summary of scaphology and the symbolism of the boat. I mean, in my book Holographic Culture, I do talk about cytology, which is a branch from scaphology, because cytology is a representation of vessels. So if you like, scaphology is the representation of scaph, which is a boat or a ship within the religious and the mythological tradition. But the other way of representing a boat is as a vessel. In English, we would say a vessel to denote a boat, but a vessel is a type of container. But this is also found within the ancient mysteries as well. So a vessel can denote both a carrier or a container, such as a seed basket, but can also denote a boat. And so you're seeing, for example, with the opening wheels, sometimes the opening wheels are represented as barrels. The barrel is equated with a boat or a ship. And again, the barrel in the symbolism, which is a flying ship or a vessel, is used to denote a heavy wheel. So this is a large carrier vessel. So when they wanted to represent a large wheel, they would sometimes represent it as a barrel. And when you think about it, it's very obvious because the barrel is a vessel, so it's a ship. It's heavy, but it's also circular. If you look at the edge of the barrel, it's a circle. So it's this heavy wheel, which were often very large. They were carried on boats and are equated with boats and vessels. And so this is a cytological symbol. It's a cytological signifier. Again, the shield is a cytological signifier because it can also be a vessel which is used to contain oil, but it can also be it's also implicit of the scaphological tradition because the symbology is combined together. So we're seeing that the vessel is interchangeable with the scaphological tradition. So that's a quick summary, if you like, of some of the different discourses which I look at within my book, holographic culture. I mean, it is quite an in-depth book. It took me 8 years to put together, because I think what's very different from my book is when you look at ancient mythology, and particularly when you look at ancient aliens, there's not really a lot of very good academic work done within this subject, and the work which has been done is often very questionable. You know, they'll talk about the Sumerian language. Well, you know, I have a problem with the Sumerian language, because we have to go on what we've been told by the Disciperati, the deceivers, and I think that a lot of the etymologies are problematic. We are told that the Sumerian language is non-Indo-European language, so what language is it related to? Because if you don't know what the language it's related to, how do you actually decode what the Sumerian is? And so I think that within the, what's ironic about this is the Disciperati, they've usurped this, and they control this. They've hijacked this discourse. And so they're using allegory in order to convey modern mythologies through, for example, through the mythology of Sumeria, the Akkadian language. And so my book, it's took me 8 years, because it's not a copy and paste job. It's not based on other people's work. It's based on going into the dictionaries and looking at, well, what did the Arabic dictionary say? What did the Latin say? What did the Hebrew say? What did the Greek say? And deconstructing that. And when you do that, you find that there is this uniform code. It's within every language. Now, my wife is Japanese, and therefore I've got a little bit of familiarity with the Japanese language, not much. But I also know that with having a little bit of familiarity with the Japanese, the way in which they represent and the way in which they symbolize the deity and the vessel is exactly the same. So, as we said before, there's a connection between the emissary and a missile, which is a flying shield, which is equated with a boat, which is another word for the opening wheels, which again are equated with thrones and chariots, or a throne chariot. But in the Japanese tradition, they represent the same thing, circular vessels. So, for example, in Japan, you'll see a tree, and you'll see a tree which has knotted paper going around the tree. And you might say to yourself, I wonder what that represents. Well, they're doing exactly the same as what the Hebrews did and the Greeks and the Romans did. They were using what is known as polymorphic symbolism. So a word has multiple meanings. Now, in Japanese, kami, which is paper, is polymorphic of kami, which is a god. So they are denoting a god. And we see, therefore, that the tree is used to represent a vessel. Now, we know this because one of the old words for a hollow tree is a utsonofune, a hollow tree. But again, it's polymorphic. Utsonofune, a hollow tree, also means a hollow boat. And so it's representing a god or a deity equated with a hollow boat. Now, within Japanese prints, you'll see, for example, I think Hiroshige. Hiroshige did a print of a hollow tree, which is another depiction of a hollow vessel or a hollow ship. In Edo prints, the hollow ship is represented as a flying saucer. It's typically shown as being circular or round. And so Utsunofune is found within Japanese folklore, and they're depicted traditionally as flying saucers. But within symbolism, they're depicted as a hollow tree. And are combined with kami, which is knotted paper, which is a contract, kami, which is a god. But another way of representing this is the way that Hiroshige did with the wolf or the fox. So the fox is equated with the will-o'-the-wisp, which is fire. But again, you see that there's a correspondence also with kami, a god, and kami, which is a wolf, which is equated with the dog star. And the, in particular, in the Japanese mythology, with the tengu. The Tengu are these entities which are reptilian entities, and they are equated with the dog star. So within Japanese prints, you'll often see a Tengu riding on a dog. Sometimes there's a star icon as well. And so we know that this is referring to Sirius. So the Tengu are one and the same with the seraphim. They're equated with boats or a hollow tree. Now, within Shinto symbolism, the hollow tree, therefore, is used to demarcate the shrines. So you have these hollow trees around the shrine, which is used to represent a boat or a vessel. In some of the shrines, they also have boats as well within the shrines. And what do they have on top of the boats? Well, they have what is used to denote a yen mark. But the yen mark in Japanese is a Japanese character meaning circle. So when you combine what is a gateway or a doorway, literally meaning a circle, with a boat, you get a circle boat, which is a utsu no fune, which they represent as a hollow tree, which is demarcated around their temple shrines. Why? Because they were burying, they were taking these vessels and they were burying, they buried these vessels or ships underneath the temple precinct, in the same way that the Semites and the Greeks did. Hence, in the Greek, we see that there's a correspondence between nos, a boat, naos, which is a temple sanctuary. In the in English, we would say that there's a connection with the nave of the church, navis, which is a boat. Again, in English, we would say worship. We are venerating these angelic boats or vessels, which are identified with lordship, which is one who is born of a boat, which is this angelic lineage. And again, worship in English is a polyglottal symbol. It works in multiple languages. So, for example, worship is rendered in the Semitic languages as sabbat, to praise, to glorify, which is equated with sabaoth, which is the host. Sabaoth, the host, is identified with sevet, a crew of a vessel, equated with tevah, which is an ark, boat, or ship. Again, tevah was used also to denote Noah's ark. So the Noah's boat is the same type of vessel used by the angelic host. In the Japanese mythology, the utsu no fune conveyed the Japanese nobles to Japan. And again, many of the population was said to have been conveyed to Japan through these utsu no fune. Same tradition, same representation. They are worshipping these boats. And again, this is found within the artifact, because within the Japanese traditions of the Tengu, we see that there's this etymology between Tengu and Tango, which is a word. Okay, because remember that they have impregnated our language with these symbols. But we're finding the same also within the Hebrew language. Ivrit, which is the Hebrew language, is coming from the etymology of ifrit, which is a type of jinn. Frita, which is to deceive. Again, the Latin language, latens, is to hide or to conceal. To hide or to conceal is referring to the occult tradition. Oculus an eye, Dracos an eye, Dracane, to watch, to flash. Office, a serpent, and ops, which is an eye. And again, but it's very interesting when you're looking at the language of the serpent, because again, in Hebrew, Safa language is related to seraph, polyglottal in the Japanese. Tengu, tango, a word. So language is equated with the serpent. The serpent has taken human language and it's hijacked the human language. Its signature is found within human language and it's found within polyglottal symbols. Now, people like Chomsky, the linguist Chomsky, referred to a universal grammar. Right, and universal grammar is essentially that all human beings are wired up in the same way and that language operates and works in a similar way. Yes, this is true, but language has been but in many respects it was debated, and many linguists said, well, does universal grammar exist? We have no proof of this. Yes, we do have proof of this. We have proof of this through polyglottal symbolism. But polyglottal symbolism proves that this language has been, shall we say, usurped. It's been insinuated. So human language, the serpent has insinuated itself through human language, through polyglottal symbolism, which is this universal grammar. And the proof for universal grammar is found within polyglottal symbolism. It's no longer a speculation. We can prove it through polyglottal symbolism, which is arcane oracle symbols. And again, the word arcane is related to ark, which is this angelic vessel, which is classical tradition, classis, a naval fleet, which is classified. And so the arcane tradition is relating to the archons, an orcas, which is a large vessel, ark, which is this classified tradition, going back to the naval tradition, which goes back to the nave of the church and the worship of these deities. Therefore, the votive dish is represented as a wheel, as a flying wheel. And they were making blood sacrifices to these entities. And so to me, this is absolutely amazing, because when you begin to put back the ship back in to the connection with the sailor, then the ufological tradition begins to make sense. It's not pie in the sky. It goes back thousands of years. It can be traced back to thousands of years. And again, the symbol of the coin. The coin is about redemption. The coin is circular because it's representing the opening wheels. And again, the ancient coins, like the modern coins, often had serrated edges because they were denoting the cog and the tooth, denotational of the opening wheels. And so, and I haven't I published this a little bit, but I've got more research on this. Within the traditions of redemption, which is to buy back, and the coin is a symbol of redemption. But what's very interesting is that the ancient Semites, they represented these different angelic carriers from different star systems as different weighted coins. So different weighted coins equate to different angelic vessels, which are identified with redemption and these votive dishes. The votive dish represents an axle and wheel, which hieroglyphically denotes Sirius. It's the same glyph as Sirius, but is used to denote the opening wheels combined with the watching eye, denotation of the watchers. The watchers are the shining ones, which is another word for the Elohim. Erin, a watcher or shining one, which is identified with Awim, a serpent. Very interestingly, when we look at the traditions of Amran, Amran talked about Erin, which were the watchers or the shining ones. He is the father of Moses, and Amran described in the Apocrypha tradition the Erin, the watchers or the shining ones, that they had the face of a viper. So we know that the Erin, a watcher or a shining one, is the same as Sopheth, which is a watcher identified with Seraph, which is a serpent. Now, this is important because when you look at the rendition of Erin, which is a watcher or shining one, etymologically they're equated with both Awim, the serpent, but also the Elohim. The Elohim are equated with Erin, a watcher or a shining one. Hence the word plays polyglottal in the Greek. Theos, a god, Theros, the watcher, Phos, which is light. Watchers are the shining ones, are these deities represented by the eye, Drakon and I, Drakane, which is to watch. The sentinel, Drakon is a sentinel, Drakos and I, which is Theos, the god, Theros, the watcher. So, which is the occult tradition, that which is hidden, pertaining to the jinn. Jinn, Janna, to hide or to conceal, related to Junna, a shield, which is denotational of the royal offspring. So, that's in summary, is some of the key themes that are explored within holographic culture. I'll just pause there and I'll see if you have any questions. I think in the second half we can talk about what we mean by a holographic culture and what that implications has. I know from studying your work that you are very conversant with this, and you articulate this very well in terms of modern day experiences. But I can articulate this from, shall we say, from a mythological perspective, how this would be symbolized. But if you have any questions.
Yeah, that would be great. That wasn't so much a summary, Pierre, as a tour de force, and my head was spinning. And just a few quick correspondences, because the way I processed what you were saying, of course, there's the bark or the boat of Ra that traverses the sky. There's the story of Charon, the ferryman, across the river Styx into the underworld. And what do? They give a coin to Charon. Oftentimes, they put the coin in the mouth of the deceased or in the eyes of the deceased. And then we talk about the Admiralty Maritime Law, where the various crowns and monarchies issued these charters to the East India Trading Company, the Virginia Trading Company, the Hudson Bay, the South African Trading Company, et cetera, and they went around and they conquered, but it was all based on Admiralty Maritime Law. And then you fast forward to the recent past. Forgive me, the guy's name escapes me, but the guy is a true hero, Gary, forget his surname, but he was the one that broke into the classified databases in America and determined that there was this fleet and those of us that are, you know, study the more modern aspects of so-called ufology, we know that the United States Navy and Naval Intelligence in particular has had a long-standing, deep involvement in not only the back engineering and analysis of recovered alien technology, but also at some level interacting with these non-human beings. So, well, we're just getting started. And thank you so much for an absolutely enlightening first segment. Could you give our listeners and viewers your website, Pierre?
Yeah, okay. If you're interested in my work, please visit my website, Pierre Sabaka Books. I've got a YouTube channel as well, so I do put up a YouTube. So if you want to subscribe, that would be great. I do try and answer questions or add comments and try and interact with people who go on YouTube and want to make comments. I mean, it's sometimes very difficult because I'm very busy and I'm pulled in lots of different directions. So sometimes I can respond to everyone. Sometimes I can only respond to a few questions. Sometimes I might respond immediately. Sometimes it might be a couple of weeks time. It all really depends. But I do try and make an effort to try and interact with people who are interested in my work. And I try to elicit respectful debate, because we don't have the answers. And I get frustrated within ufology when people are tearing one another to pieces. But what we need to be moving towards is consolidation, because none of us have all of the answers, but many of us have very important and different pieces to the puzzle. And so we need to be pulling together and consolidating. And I think in these questionable times, we really need more consolidation. And so, again, when people go onto my site and they make comments, I do encourage people to make respectful comments and to respect people's opinions and to be polite in terms of how they interact with individuals and represent their ideas. So that's, to me, that's important. And I think that we need to be having this open discussion, this open discourse. We need to be throwing our egos out of the window, so to speak, and we need to be working together in a spirit of cooperation, in a spirit of consolidation. And I think that this is very interesting in the UK, because certainly I've been working with people like Anthony Beckett, who's part of who created Exopolitics Great Britain. I've also been working with Neil Haig. He's got a new book coming out. And Chris Turner, I'm very familiar with his work. And all of these authors and writers, they all, and again, Philip Kinsella as well, he's an abductee. But all of these authors, they all work in a spirit of cooperation and consolidation. And certainly this is what I'm trying to encourage through my work. And again, with your work, I'm very respectful of your work, because I feel that my work is academic, but what you're doing is you're giving a face to this phenomenon. You're showing the experiential part of what this phenomenon constitutes, how it impacts upon people's life. And so when we combine my expertise with your expertise, then this really does make a lot of sense, and it begins to make a lot more sense.
Thank you for that, Pierre. And for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.